Chapter 24 War in Iraq. It was the fall of 2002, a year after 9/11, and the Pentagon was secretly preparing to go to war in Iraq. The CIA was assigned a more traditional role in the lead-up to this war, to prepare the battlefield with hidden-hand operations, including sabotage, subversion, and assassination, OSS style. An unmarked aircraft filled with 80 anti-Saddam guerrilla fighters from Iraq crossed into Nevada airspace and made its way toward a classified facility within the Nevada test site, a secret test and training facility known as Area 51. This newly created foreign paramilitary force, codenamed the Scorpions, was commanded by General Mohammed Abdullah al-Shawani, exiled arch-nemesis of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The aircraft curtains were closed on approach, so no one inside the airplane could identify the training facility or leak information. Plausible deniability was essential. Americans had no idea the White House was laying plans for another war. The Scorpion Guerrilla Warfare Corps was one element of a CIA covert action operation, codename DB Anabasis. DB was the agency's cryptonym for Iraq. Anabasis referred to the soldier historian Xenophon's epic masterpiece, Anabasis, the story of an army of Greek mercenaries who tried to seize the Persian throne in 370 BC but failed. "One of the great adventures in human history," remarked historian Will Durant of the effort. The planners of DB Anabasis had equally high hopes for their program, which presaged one of the most egregious wrongs in American military history. The two men in charge of the program were Louis Rueda, Chief of Iraq Operations, and John McGuire, Deputy Chief. "I know Iraq," said McGuire in a 2018 interview for this book. He had run operations in the country since 1991. "I still have a home in Baghdad, which I visit." The pair brought range and experience to the table. Rueda, a Cuban-American, came from a family of freedom fighters and spies. His father, Tomas, was a member of Brigade 2506, which stormed the beach at the Bay of Pigs. Enamored with paramilitary operations since childhood, Luis Rueda joined the CIA after college and spent years working covert operations in Latin America and the Middle East. He'd served as chief of station in Delhi, India, and was now a member of the elite Senior Intelligence Service. From his office on the seventh floor at Langley, Rueda would oversee DB Anabasis plans. The fieldwork would be handled by McGuire, a legendary paramilitary operations officer whose areas of expertise included explosives and sabotage. McGuire was old school and proud of it, trained in the Directorate of Operations under Bill Casey. "Bush wanted an Iraqi version of the OSS Jedburghs," says McGuire. "He was already thinking about this when I was called back to Washington on September 12th. McGuire believed in the effectiveness of OSS Special Operations Branch style operations, he says. He discussed this in a meeting at the White House during the first week after the 9/11 attacks. McGuire saw counterterrorism operations through a historical lens. "I worked on the issue even before there was a counterterrorist center at the CIA," he remembers, including when Bill Casey, taking a page out of Mossad's book, drafted the original plan to train Lebanese hit squads to eliminate Hezbollah terrorists. Casey's thinking was way ahead of his time, McGuire insists. With President Bush's signature on the September 17 Memorandum of Notification, The CIA got what Bill Casey envisioned 2 decades before, he adds. In 2002, the concept of using kill-or-capture missions as a primary means of combating terrorism was in its first official year. How to use a rebel army of foreign fighters to augment these lethal direct action operations gave way to the Scorpions, the first of many war on terror partnerships to come. But out at Area 51, problems with these Iraqi emigres began almost immediately. The unit was supposed to be made up of elite commandos, many of whom claimed to have previously worked for Saddam Hussein's paramilitary army, the Fedayeen Saddam, Saddam's men of sacrifice, before defecting. But one of the U.S. paramilitary operators assigned to train these Iraqi nationals complained to headquarters that an unusual number of the Scorpion fighters appeared to lack even the most basic military skills. John McGuire acknowledged the concern, but was not worried, he says. The Scorpion's commander, General Mohammed Abdullah al-Shawani, was a longtime trusted ally of the CIA. General Shawani had a complex backstory. In 1984, during Iraq's war with Iran, Shawani led a successful helicopter attack against an Iranian stronghold in northern Iraq, elevating him to national hero status. But this popularity was a curse, causing the paranoid and jealous Saddam Hussein to view the general as a threat. Shawani was arrested and jailed on suspicion of plotting a coup. He was questioned and released without charge, but the experience led him to defect to England, where he began working with the CIA. With agency backing, Shawani plotted another coup, this time from outside the country. Before the coup happened, he was betrayed as a co-conspirator. In revenge, Saddam's Mukhbarat rounded up 85 men suspected of working with General Shawani and executed them. Shawani's 3 sons, all still living in Iraq, were arrested and tortured to death. "I fight to avenge my sons," Shawani told Time magazine in 2004. "I will do whatever is required." Out in the Nevada desert in the fall of 2002, General Shawani's Scorpions were trained in unconventional warfare, ambush, hit-and-run operations, and helicopter insertion. They learned how to use explosives to blow up railway lines and power plants inside Iraq. They trained in close-quarters combat and long-range sniper assassination. Were they good soldiers? A paramilitary operator who worked with the Scorpions asked rhetorically in an interview for this book. No comment. Were they wild? Yes, very wild, he says. But General Mo, Mohammed Shawani, was in charge of them. He kept them in control. To understand how the general's paramilitary unit came to be, it's necessary to back up to February 16, 2002, just 5 months after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. President Bush signed a presidential finding authorizing DB Anabasis in Iraq. The CIA's lawyers were concerned that Title 50 operations in Iraq would not be covered under the September 17 Memorandum of Notification because no link between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda had been found. The presidential finding was to grant the CIA the authority to make certain a rebel fighting force was in place when the war the White House was now planning came to pass. An argument over which rebel group inside Iraq was best suited to work on DB Anabasis ensued. Some people within the Iraq Operations Group believed that the most competent and loyal anti-Saddam fighters were the Peshmerga, a guerrilla army of Kurdish fighters from northern Iraq. The Peshmerga had been oppressed by Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party for decades. In 1988, Iraq's military used mustard gas and nerve agents, including sarin and VX, on Kurdish civilians living in Halabja, killing 5,000 people in the largest chemical weapons attack in history. But the Peshmerga, whose name translates as those who face death, had their own internecine problems and were presently divided into two rival groups. In April 2002, John McGuire flew to Iraqi Kurdistan to meet separately with the regional Kurdish leaders of these groups. Masoud Barzani, president of the Kurdish Democratic Party, and Jalal Talabani, president of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Barzani and Talabani were very skeptical of what we had planned, remembers McGuire. They'd heard this kind of proposal from us before. I told them, this time it's for real. After listening to McGuire's briefing on operations being planned under DB anabasis, Barzani and Talabani each expressed wariness. The efforts would be threefold, said McGuire. Locate assets inside Saddam Hussein's regime who could be turned, sabotage existing Iraqi infrastructure, and assassinate Mukhbarat officials. There was risk involved, he added. The hit-and-run operations against the Mukhbarat would almost certainly result in retaliatory attacks. Rivals Barzani and Talabani agreed to set aside their differences and work with the CIA to fight their common enemy, Saddam Hussein. Before leaving Iraqi Kurdistan, McGuire asked to be taken in behind enemy lines. He wanted to observe an Iraqi military base for himself, he says. If McGuire were captured, he'd likely be executed on the spot, or put on trial for being the spy that he was. As a disguise, McGuire's Peshmerga hosts outfitted him in the stolen uniform of an Iraqi army colonel, complete with red stripes on the shoulders. In a car favored by Iraqi colonels, a four-door Toyota sedan like an American police cruiser, the Peshmerga took McGuire to the outskirts of an Iraqi army base, where he observed through binoculars soldiers keeping guard. They were sitting around in shorts and flip-flops, McGuire recalls. I was looking at the Iraqi V-Corps, and they looked entirely unprepared for war. Mission accomplished, McGuire headed back to Langley. Upon his return, Vice President Cheney requested a personal briefing on DB anabasis. The meeting took place in a conference room on the 7th floor of CIA headquarters. Rueda and McGuire shared with the vice president their plans for covert action operations in Iraq. Cheney asked many questions, recalls McGuire. There was a lot of back and forth. We answered his questions. He listened, then asked more questions. He was interested in who we were working with. We said the Kurds. He wanted to know specifics. He was very involved. There was another problem that needed to be addressed, an issue McGuire insists he'd brought up the last time he'd briefed the vice president. 4 days after 9/11, says McGuire, the meeting had been at the White House. The issue was Iran, Iraq, Syria. The three were tied, we said. If you pull one brick out, the whole region could collapse. We tried building this into our thinking. Iran, Syria, Iraq. McGuire was not alone in his assessment. In Israel, Mossad had been tracking a devil's bargain made recently between Syria and Iran involving Hezbollah, Iran's guerrilla army corps. For decades, Syrian President Hafez al-Assad had allowed the Iranians to fly weapons into Damascus, then disperse them to Hezbollah terrorists in the region via trucks. In exchange for passage, President Assad received cash and anonymity, meaning Syria's involvement remained hidden. In 2000, he died, and his son Bashar became the new president of Syria and renegotiated with Iran the terms of the secret bargain with Hezbollah. According to Mossad, a year and a half into his presidency, in early 2002, Bashar al-Assad struck a new deal with the Iranians. Assad opened his own army's armories to Hezbollah, providing the organization with modern Russian weaponry that even Iran lacked, explains Ronan Bergman. Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria had formed an alliance that posed an existential threat to Israel. Mossad called this triumvirate the Radical Front. McGuire says he told Vice President Cheney that if Iraq were to become destabilized, the Radical Front could take advantage of this weakness, move its hidden hand forces into Iraq, and take ground. Cheney did not need to be convinced of Iran's intent to harm the West. In a speech at the Nixon Library 2 months before, he had called Iran a leading exporter of terror. But during the DB Anabasis briefing at CIA, McGuire says that the potential for Iran to meddle in a weakened Iraq was not further discussed, that Cheney was focused on Iraq. The briefing ended. The vice president expressed his approval for CIA's covert action operations with the Peshmerga. "He told us, 'You have my full support,'" says McGuire. McGuire returned to his office. He picked up the telephone and spoke to a veteran officer from the Near East Division named Charles Sam Faddis, giving Faddis the go-ahead to lead covert operations inside northern Iraq. Faddis had 3 months to prepare. Sam Faddis had been a clandestine case officer at the CIA since 1988. He spoke fluent Turkish and conversational Arabic, had a degree in political science, and was also trained as a military lawyer with the Judge Advocate General's Corps, or JAG. In the months since 9/11, Faddis had been working clandestine operations in Pakistan along its lawless frontier border with Afghanistan. Now, he would be leading a CIA paramilitary team into Iraqi Kurdistan to work with Peshmerga rebels. Orders in hand, Faddis put together the most experienced spies, soldiers, and combat veterans he could find, experts in reconnaissance, surveillance, covert operations, and warfare. Among them, they spoke Arabic, Turkish, Farsi, and Kurdish. Two had served in Afghanistan, fighting in Kabul and Tora Bora. One had been at the Kali-e-Jangi prisoner uprising and fought alongside Mike Spann. In northern Iraq, the plan was for the CIA paramilitary teams to eventually be augmented with operators from Delta Force, Green Berets, U.S. Army Rangers, and other special operations forces. On July 7, 2002, Faddis and a CIA paramilitary team arrived in Incirlik, Turkey, where regional politics were growing increasingly complex. The Kurds had a long-standing feud with the Turks, and it took several days of bargaining before the CIA team was allowed in. Once approved, they climbed into jeeps loaded with weapons and ammunition and drove 425 miles to a border crossing along the Karbor River in northern Iraq, just north of a Kurdish village called Zako. Once inside Iraqi Kurdistan, they were met by Peshmerga fighters who brought them to meet separately with Masoud Barzani and Jalal Talabani, as John McGuire had done 3 months before. From Barzani and Talabani, the teams were briefed on a developing situation along the border with Iran. Islamist fighters aligned with al-Qaeda had moved into the mountains there, Peshmerga leaders said. They'd set up a training camp and were running guerrilla warfare operations in a narrow set of hills that rose up from the Halabja Plain. The Peshmerga had captured dozens of these guerrilla fighters, recalls Faddis. This Islamist army, which numbered between 200 and 1,000 men, had taken over several Kurdish towns. Local villagers described brutish, Taliban-like restrictions and said the foreign fighters destroyed local Sufi shrines. The radical group called themselves Ansar al-Islam, Defenders of Islam. There were local Kurds in their ranks, but mostly they were non-locals, said to have journeyed here from Afghanistan. There was open-source information supporting these eyewitness accounts. Earlier that winter, in January 2002, the Kurdistan Observer reported on a document found in Kabul that called upon Sunni Kurds to join al-Qaeda and create a little Tora Bora in northern Iraq. The goal was to create a fighting force to expel Jews and Christians from Kurdistan, join the way of jihad, and rule every piece of land with Islamic Sharia rule. By summer of 2002, the fighting had begun. Ansar al-Islam attacked and killed 103 Peshmerga in an ambush. They tried to assassinate a Peshmerga military commander in Sulaymaniyya, but killed his office manager and four bodyguards instead. Faddis asked to be taken to the front lines to view the training camps and interview captured POWs. Dressed like Peshmerga fighters and armed with Peshmerga weapons, the CIA team was taken to the lawless border region with Iran. "We got eyes on al-Qaeda and Ansar al-Islam," recalls Faddis. Their heavy machine gun positions and mortar sites were hidden inside medieval castles across the region. The team interrogated prisoners and determined that the fighters were al-Qaeda who'd escaped from Afghanistan. They journeyed across Iran using ancient smugglers' routes and were rebuilding an army to fight American soldiers in the coming war in Iraq. "In the second week of August 2002, says Faddis, "we put together a plan to attack and destroy the Ansar enclave." He sent CIA headquarters a list of weapons required to arm the Peshmerga rebels: 500 120-millimeter mortars, 2,000 Kalashnikov rifles, 50,000 7.62-millimeter rounds, the cable read. Washington's answer shocked Faddis. "The White House decided that they would not approve us standing up a Kurdish force to fight with us against Ansar. The president had decided to place the priority on invading Iraq instead. This was a radical change of plans," he says. "The White House now wanted an Arab face. The rebels needed to be Iraqi Arabs, not Kurdish Peshmerga," he was told, "and that General Shawani's Iraqi Scorpions were to be this Arab face. They were not to be used against Ansar. They were to be used against Saddam." After finishing training in the Nevada desert, the Scorpions were flown to a second training base in Jordan. By the time they arrived in northern Iraq, the group numbered several hundred. To Faddis, the idea of working covert operations behind enemy lines with men he had no proven relationship with seemed unwise. He discussed his concerns with a team member, callsign Doc, the medic who'd been at Kala Ijongi when Mike Spann was ambushed and killed. Faddis says Doc agreed that they should conduct additional vetting on their own. They would screen General Shawani's paramilitary force individually before agreeing to work with them. A neutral facility was chosen, inside a hotel near Shaklawa, Iraq. Each member of the Scorpions was stripped of his weapons and interviewed. Most of them were common criminals, according to Faddis. No military background whatsoever. General Shawani got paid per person he supplied to the CIA. After screening more than 100 men, the CIA team agreed that there were just 25 of the Iraqi Scorpions they were willing to fight alongside. But with close-quarters combat training, Faddis says a complex new set of unforeseen problems arose. The Scorpions were raping each other during training, says Faddis, which possesses its own set of problems, including medical ones. What do you do when people start committing felonies during paramilitary training at a black site? They're committing felonies, but officially they don't exist, and neither does the program. Faddis had spent more than a decade engaged in covert operations across the Near and Middle East. Man-on-man sex is not unusual in this culture, he says. It's not frowned upon. It occurs. The fighters go home to their wives if they have them. But as the leader of this highly classified DB anabasis operation, being privy to rape presented Faddis with an ethical and operational conundrum. What I was dealing with was non-consensual sex among the fighters sent by Washington. The ongoing rapes among the Scorpion fighters were reported to the Iraqi operations group at Langley. Headquarters sent veteran Special Activities Division officer Greg Vogel to Kurdistan to assess the situation. It was Greg Vogel who'd saved Hamid Karzai's life in the bombing incident in Kandahar in December 2001. Vogel went by the code name Snake. Snake declared the Scorpions unfit for combat, according to Faddis. They were undisciplined, unskilled fighters now committing criminal acts. He told headquarters that the Scorpions were unable to perform any of the missions they'd been trained for. "We are going to get good men killed for no reason," Snake warned. But the plan to use the Scorpion fighters moved forward despite protestations from the CIA paramilitary team in the field. General Shawani was supplied with Russian Mi-17 helicopters, millions of dollars worth of air assets, recalls Faddis, all painted with Scorpion logos, all bright and shiny and brand new. In At the Center of the Storm, his memoir, CIA Director George Tenet praised the Scorpions, identifying them as an agency-sponsored paramilitary group that produced extraordinary successes. General Shawani, Tenet wrote, served as one of the U.S. government's most critical partners working against Saddam's regime. He was a born leader with a significant following, someone who commanded the respect of everyone who worked with him. Michael Hayden, who became CIA director in 2005, also praised Shawani in his memoir, Playing to the Edge, calling him a friend who was clearly talented and courageous. The discrepancy in opinion between the covert action operators on the ground and the top brass at the CIA is puzzling. According to Faddis, Washington wanted the Iraqi Jedburgh story. What they got was an unmitigated disaster. As Sam Faddis focused his operations in partnership with the Peshmerga rebels, Saddam Hussein sent Mukhabarat hit squads to try to assassinate them, Faddis says. The assassins also included Islamists from Ansar al-Islam. In February 2003, CIA liaison Shakwat Haji Mushir, a Peshmerga guerrilla commander and Patriotic Union of Kurdistan government official, was shot in the head at close range by a man posing as a peace negotiator. The Peshmerga pushed back against Ansar al-Islam, while the CIA team focused their attention on the Mukhabarat assassination teams dispatched to eliminate them. Iraq's state-run intelligence organization was notorious for torturing and killing its enemies. Its staff numbered roughly 4,000. Like the CIA, the Mukhbarat was responsible for international intelligence collection and analysis, but it also performed paramilitary or hidden hand operations inside Iraq. The unit responsible for assassinations was called Directorate 9 Secret Operations. As part of DB Anabasis, the CIA sought to turn a Mukhbarat assassin into a Special Activities Division asset. On three occasions, recalls Faddis, we set up meetings in locations we could control and then captured members of Mukhbarat assassination teams. The operators found the double agent they were looking for in a lieutenant colonel who worked for the Mukhbarat office in Mosul. From this asset, the team learned that Saddam Hussein also wanted to capture an American alive, to put him on trial in Baghdad, get CNN and BBC world coverage, and then hang him. The Mukhbarat officer agreed to act as a double agent in exchange for a large quantity of American cash. First, the CIA team created a scenario whereby this lieutenant colonel appeared to have succeeded in assassinating an American. They dressed one of their own in the uniform of a U.S. Army colonel, put him in a ditch on the side of a mountain road, covered him with mock blood, and photographed him as if he'd been assassinated. The asset brought the pictures to the Mukhbarat field office in Mosul. The branch chief was pleased and forwarded the photographs onto Baghdad to be shown to Saddam Hussein. The reply was high praise. The asset brought Faddis a memo he'd received that read, "You've killed a high-ranking American Special Forces Operations Commander. Now get one alive." The CIA paramilitary team sought to lure a Mukhbarat snatch-and-grab team to a meeting point in Erbil, where they could ambush the team. Messages were exchanged by courier. But at the last minute, the asset's branch chief in Mosul requested a cell phone call with the asset before he sent the unit to Erbil. The call was arranged with the CIA listening in. "You could almost feel sorry for the Mukhbarat chief in Mosul," remembers Faddis. "You could almost hear exactly what was going on in his head, to pull this off and be a great hero in the eyes of Saddam. On the other hand, you could also hear that he was not an idiot. In the world of espionage and betrayal, nuance is key." The CIA interpreter listened carefully to the Arabic subtleties in the words spoken. When the call ended, the interpreter told the case officer that he believed the team's Mukhbarat asset had been made. The mission was called off. "The case officer was right," says Faddis. "We never heard from the Mukhbarat officer in Mosul again. But they heard from us. In response, for all the times the Mukhbarat tried to kill us, we had a team build a satchel charge in a briefcase, which one of our Kurdish assets took into Mosul." Faddis was referring to a World War II-era demolition device made of dynamite or C4 plastic explosive and designed to look like a simple courier bag. The asset walked into the Mukhbarat headquarters in Mosul, placed it on the ground floor, and quickly left. "It blew the shit out of most of the building," remembers Faddis. "The ensuing fire destroyed the rest of the structure, burned it down to the ground." That there was pressure from Washington, D.C. to find a pretext for military action was increasingly impossible to ignore. The White House was determined to go to war in Iraq regardless of the evidence at hand. In February 2003, Secretary of State Colin Powell, went before the United Nations, citing information provided by D.B. Anabasis that Ansar al-Islam was training terrorists in the mountains of northern Iraq. Then came the untruthful twist on the facts. Baghdad has an agent in the most senior levels of the radical organization, Powell said, insisting that Saddam Hussein was working with Ansar al-Islam. The speech would prove disastrous for Powell, who would later call it a blot on his record of national service. It eventually became entwined with the false foundations upon which the Iraq War was built. This is an example of the dark side of covert action, how operations designed to remain hidden can so easily be deliberately manipulated or contrived. The construct of plausible deniability can be used by a president and his advisors to build a house of cards. As the United States prepared to invade Iraq in 2003, the CIA paramilitary team watched Ansar al-Islam fighters who'd been holed up in the mountains pack up and move out. On the eve of the war, they watched the Scorpion Guerrilla Warfare Corps commit mutiny and vanish. They simply disappeared, Faddis maintains. In the early morning hours of March 21, 64 Tomahawk cruise missiles were fired against the Ansar al-Islam terrorist training camp in Iraqi Kurdistan. Paramilitary officers with the Special Activities Division, alongside Green Berets, infantry soldiers from the 10th Mountain Division, and more than 1,000 Peshmerga fighters, fought a 10-hour battle with the terrorists, with orders to kill or capture anyone left alive. From the dead, the team pulled passports identifying the fighters as having answered the call to jihad from as far away as Somalia in Africa and Dhaka in Bangladesh. Among the prisoners captured, 6 were deemed al-Qaeda enemy combatants and sent to the U.S. prison complex at Guantanamo Bay. The opening salvo in the Pentagon's war in Iraq began with a display of shock and awe force meant to paralyze Ba'ath Party infrastructure and destroy the will of Saddam Hussein's fighters to get them to surrender. Susan Hassler, a CTC analyst and early member of Alec Station, saw the writing on the wall. Shock and awe does not end wars on terrorism. It only creates more terrorism, she says. During the 1990s, Hassler sometimes edited the president's daily brief and on occasion wrote portions of Clinton's counterterrorism speeches. Uniquely familiar with covert operations against terrorist organizations, she considers hidden hand operations to be the most effective way to combat terrorism in the modern world. Big military operations encourage more terrorism, she says. Money starts to flow to terrorist groups. People become more radicalized. Wars on terror should be fought under the radar, as quietly as possible. But counter-terrorist operations are, by their nature, not very satisfying to a frightened public. After a mass casualty attack like 9/11, the public becomes enraged and unnerved and thinks they want revenge. After Baghdad fell to U.S. forces on April 9, 2003, Saddam Hussein's Mukhbarat was disbanded. The U.S.-led multinational force released Order 69, establishing a charter for a new Iraqi National Intelligence Service, or INIS. CIA strongman General Shawani, commanding general of the mutinied Scorpion paramilitary team, was named Iraq's new intelligence chief. Shawani was installed in Baghdad and presented by the Pentagon to news outlets covering the war as being a non-sectarian force able to recruit its officers and agents from all of Iraq's religious communities. His credentials for impartiality were listed as his being a Sunni from Mosul, married to a Shiite woman whose deputy hailed from Kurdistan. But privately, it was a different story. Revenge-based justice began to undergird the narrative. Lex talionis, the law of retaliation, as it was called in the ancient world. From Mosul to Najaf, vengeance was the new normal, and assassination became a law enforcement tool. Muwafiq al-Rabai, Iraq's new national security advisor, told Time magazine, "General al-Shawani calls for a mix of aggressive tactics, reinstating Saddam-era Mukhbarat intelligence professionals and carefully picking fights that can be won." Newly appointed local officials began making public threats and encouraged violence. "Be ruthless, either they kill you or you kill them, and with them there can be no mercy," the "them" being those who'd held power before. A kill-or-be-killed approach emerged. Iraq's new prime minister, Iyad Ilawi, echoed the call for retaliation-based justice. "I say that we will hunt them down to give them their just punishment," Alawi said of the old regime. One of General Shawani's first moves as chief of the Iraqi National Intelligence Service was to create his own paramilitary units to exact revenge and assassinate former enemies. By July, Time reported the general had graduated at least 5 classes from the Special Tactics Unit, STU, allegedly a new national paramilitary force. In fact, its members were trained and overseen by Special Activities Division ground branch teams. In time, STU would number 5,000 men. Soon thereafter, the Washington Post's David Ignatius reported that Iran had entered the conflict and was engaging General Shawani in tit-for-tat assassinations. "Shawani's operatives discovered the Iranians had a hit list," he wrote, "drawn from an old Ministry of Defense payroll document that identified the names and home addresses of senior officers who served under the former regime. Shawani himself was among those targeted for assassination by the Iranians." The situation spiraled out of control. The CIA had hoped that Shawani's INIS could be an effective national force and a deterrent to Iranian meddling to mount effective operations against the Iranians, the Post reported in a second article. But the fact that General Shawani had recruited the chief of the anti-Iran branch of the Saddam-era Mukhbarat made the Iranians and their Shiite allies nervous. The Radical Front, Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah began to move fighters into the chaos that was now Iraq. Farid al-Kazan, a Christian Lebanese lawmaker allied with Hezbollah, explains how Iran was able to step in and conduct operations in Iraq. "The big story became Iraq," he says of the Americans' unforeseen mistake. In their invasion in 2003, the Americans unwittingly opened it up for the Iranians. "The stakes are much higher in Iraq," he explains. "In Iraq, there is a Shiite majority, oil, the shrine cities, and borders with Saudi Arabia. This was an opportunity Iran and its proxy army Hezbollah were unwilling to overlook." Sheikh Naim Qassem, Hezbollah's deputy secretary general, acknowledged his organization's efforts to pass experience along to other Iranian-aligned forces. "Every group anywhere in the world that works as we work, with our ideas, is a win for the party," Qassem told the New York Times. "It is natural. all who are in accordance with us in any place in the world, that is a win for us, because they are part of our axis, and a win for everyone in our axis. Sam Faddis returned to Washington. A new team of Special Activities Division officers and ground branch operators were inserted into Mosul. We started getting targeted for assassination by operatives from Iran, says a ground branch sniper, call sign Zeus. We had targets on our backs. These were long-range snipers, well-trained. We were told they were from Hezbollah. A rumor started to swirl. Imad Mughniyeh was directing the operations himself. So untouchable and elusive was Mughniyeh that his nickname was Father of Smoke. Billy Wall was sent to Iraq. The missions he was assigned remain classified, but photographs show him working out of Uday Hussein's former palace in Baghdad. From there, Wall was sent on a singleton mission to the Balkans, where he received an extraordinary call. "I was in Zagreb, Croatia," remembers Wall, "when someone showed up and gave me a new passport with a new identity, a new travel visa. It was a fast go-now operation," says Wall, "to Saudi Arabia." In 40 years of covert operations for the CIA, Waugh had worked in 64 countries around the globe, but never Saudi Arabia. "I didn't know who the target was," he says. He'd learn why when he got there. Waugh landed in Riyadh. He traveled to the U.S. Embassy, where the CIA station employed roughly 100 clandestine service officers and operators. There was a Navy SEAL who'd gathered a lot of intelligence on the target. He knew where the target lived, but the SEAL didn't want to go after the target, says Waugh. The target needed to be photographed, not killed, but the SEAL told Waugh he was unwilling to pull out a camera and start taking pictures on a Riyadh street. He had concerns he'd be captured by Saudi intelligence. "Being captured in Saudi Arabia was a fate worse than death," says Waugh. "They'd torture you, probably lock you up and throw away the key." When it came time to learn the identity of the target, even Waugh, a battle-hardened clandestine operator, recalls being surprised. "The target was Imad Mughniyeh," he says, "Father of Smoke, a die-hard Hezbollah operative for Iran who loathed Saudi Arabia. What the hell was Imad Mughniyeh doing in Saudi Arabia?" Waugh wondered. Before 9/11, Imad Mughniyeh was the most wanted man in the world. Now, Billy Waugh was on a mission to do what no CIA singleton operator had been able to do in more than 20 years, get an identifiable photograph of him, without getting killed, captured, or made to disappear. Chapter 25, Imad Mughniyeh. Billy Waugh gave himself 24 hours to get the job done and get out. The Saudi intelligence apparatus, renowned for its brutality, reported directly to the king. "Whatever Mughniyeh was doing there," says Waugh, "it had to have been strictly a blackmail deal." Waugh theorized that the Saudis had something on Mughniyeh that was so tarnishing of his reputation within Hezbollah that he'd become susceptible to blackmail. "What goes on at the top level is a whole bunch of dirty shit. It was our opportunity to get in on that." To prepare to photograph Mughniyeh, Waugh studied geographical intelligence and satellite images of the city and its streets. He had the target's address, and he studied the roads in and the roads out of the area. From the Navy SEAL at the embassy, whose operation he was taking over, Waugh learned everything he could about the target's pattern of life. He became familiar with the agency camera he'd be using, a digital Canon with a 200mm lens and a 2GB SD card. To rehearse his movements, he tied and retied everything to his body in case he had to run. Early the next morning, just after the first call to prayer, a CIA driver took Hua on a driving lesson around Riyadh. Confident he'd learned the Saudi road system well enough to drive on his own, Hua told his driver to take the rest of the day off and leave the vehicle with him. Hua drove to the southeastern part of the city, to the address he'd been given. As fortune would have it, across the street from the target's apartment was a Sudanese restaurant, a busy establishment where he could conduct decent surveillance. He parked a few blocks away, walked to the restaurant, and sat down at a table. There were a bunch of people inside, black, 7 foot tall. Meant one thing, recalls Hua. They were from the Dinka tribe. Hua ordered a Sudanese coffee. I started shooting the shit about Khartoum, drank more coffee, talked a little more, got the Dinka to reminisce about the home country, even conversed a little in the native Dinka tongue. Chatting with the Sudanese tribesmen, Hua kept an eye on the target's address across the street as he began to formulate in his mind where he might best position himself in order to photograph the man. There was a Dempsey dumpster right out front. It was good cover. The distance from the dumpster to the front door of the building was about 250 feet. Hua paid for his coffee, bade the Dinka good day, and left. The following morning, around 7:30, Hua returned to the target area. He parked the vehicle and walked down the street toward the Sudanese restaurant. Concealed by his jacket was the agency camera equipment. Confident no one was watching, he climbed into the dumpster and waited. After some time, recalls Hua, the front door of the house where the target lived opened and he stepped out. He was carrying what appeared to be a set of clean clothes, covered by a see-through cover from a dry cleaner. He was a mean-looking son of a bitch, a little on the fat side. In front of the building were 10 wide steps leading down from the entrance to the street. This meant he had to walk slowly down the steps with his body at an angle so he didn't fall. It made getting nice, clear photographs of the target relatively easy for Billy Hua. As the man walked down the steps, Hua took photographs in rapid succession. Mugnia was alone, carrying the clothes. He reached his vehicle, opened the door, and hung the clothes in the back. Hua took several more photographs. He climbed out of the dumpster, walked back to his car, and drove to the U.S. Embassy building in Riyadh. Once inside the CIA station, Hua slid the camera's SD card into an agency computer and examined the photographs he'd taken from the dumpster. Excellent. They were of identification quality, he remembers. He brought them to the chief of station, who stared silently at them for some time. It was Mugnia, the chief said. They satisfied the chief of station in Riyadh. Hua prepared to leave the kingdom immediately. There was still a chance he could be stopped, arrested, and disappeared. An agency employee drove him to the airport. Using the false identity and visa provided to him by the CIA, Billy Hua vanished from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, never to return. Billy Hua's photographs confirmed the existence and location of Imad Mugnia. Now, the ultra-secret U.S. Army unit, formerly known as Gray Fox, later renamed Orange, could gather SIGINT. Hezbollah's chief of operations could be fixed and ultimately finished. The United States and Israel had individually been trying to kill or capture Imad Mugnia for decades. Now they would join forces to accomplish the task. Or maybe they already were. Mossad can't operate freely in Saudi, says Hua. It's probably the only place they don't have a major footprint. A secret arrangement was made. Provided it remained the hidden hand, the United States would assist Mossad in fixing and finishing Imad Mughniya. Just a few weeks after Waugh took the photograph of Mughniya in Riyadh, on July 19, 2004, a senior Hezbollah commander named Ghalib Awali was killed by a car bomb in the suburbs of Beirut. Awali was getting into his car when the vehicle exploded. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah accused Israel of assassinating Awali and vowed to cut off the hands of the killers. To honor their murdered brother, Hezbollah's propaganda wing created a memorial film about Awali, dispersing copies to its operatives in the region. Mossad got a hold of it and screened it for members of a combat intelligence team, Unit 8200, Israel's equivalent of the NSA. Unit 8200 collects SIGINT and decrypts codes. Its analysts, technicians, and field operators have reach and power. They are highly focused on what they look at, says Peter Roberts, director of military sciences at the Royal United Services Institute, the oldest defense science think tank in the world, certainly more focused than the NSA, and they conduct their operations with a degree of tenacity and passion that you don't experience elsewhere. For years, Unit 8200 operated without a name or an insignia. Its members are highly skilled Level 5 riflemen who have undergone extensive Special Forces training. From a classified base in the Negev Desert, which is one of the largest listening bases in the world, members of Unit 8200 follow targets using SIGINT. They monitor phone calls, emails, and other electronic communications to collect and decode. Unit 8200's Arabist linguists assigned to the Mughniya operation were shown Hezbollah's martyr film about Ghalib Awali. In one of the images, Hassan Nasrallah is seen viewing electronic maps on a computer screen. Behind him stands a bearded man wearing glasses and a cap. In the photographs of Mughniya taken by Billy Waugh, a key identification marker was obtained, namely the size of the target's earlobes and the distance between them. This may have helped confirm to intelligence officers that the man in Hezbollah's martyr film was indeed Mughniya. Unit 8200 confirmed Mughniya's identity by his voice. There was a disagreement about how and when to move. If Mossad didn't act swiftly, one group feared that Mughniya would vanish into thin air. Mossad chief Meir Dagan had the final word. "Don't worry," he reportedly told his operatives. "His day will come." Here began a clandestine joint effort between the intelligence services of the United States and Israel to track down Mughniya and kill him. A new form of intelligence emerged called HUGINT, the synthesis of human intelligence and signals intelligence. It is said to have been invented at Mossad, with credit for its development going to an officer named Yossi Cohen. He had worked for Mossad's Junction Unit, a special operations team that oversees asset recruitment around the world. Yossi Cohen became the director of Mossad in 2016. Israeli press describes Yossi Cohen as someone belonging in a Le Carré novel, a master linguist, soldier, and spy. In addition to his native tongue, he is said to speak flawless English, French, and Arabic. He runs marathons and is called the model, owing to his good looks and stylish dress. For years, when he was undercover, he went by the moniker Y. At Mossad, the discipline of HUGINT requires the acquisition of the most private, scandalous details about enemies, for the purpose of blackmailing them and turning them into assets. To this end, Mossad collects information on infidelities, illicit sexual encounters, drug use, porn habits, the taking of bribes, and anything else that compromises the reputations of allegedly pious members of terrorist organizations, including Hezbollah and Hamas. Leaked documents indicate such vulnerabilities, if exposed, would likely call into question a radicalizer's devotion to the jihadist cause, leading to the degradation or loss of his authority. Unit 8200 tapped phone lines and undersea cables, planted electronic monitoring devices, and used mini drones and other surveillance platforms equipped with electronic devices to listen in. Owing to Hugin, Mossad was able to turn operators inside Hezbollah and Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard into assets. After Wa photographed Mughniyeh in Saudi Arabia, Mughniyeh returned to Lebanon, where he was assigned by Iranian commanders to undermine U.S. forces in Iraq. Hezbollah had developed a dedicated unit to train Iraqi Shia militia under Imad Mughniyeh and several of his key deputies, says Matthew Levitt, an expert on Hezbollah. General David Petraeus, U.S. commander of forces in Iraq, told Congress that Iran was arming, training, and directing fighters into a Hezbollah-like force to serve Iran's interests and fight a proxy war against the Iraqi state and coalition forces. He said that it was Iran that was supplying armor-piercing IEDs, called explosively formed projectiles, to the Mahdi Army, Iran's action arm in Iraq. These explosive devices had already killed more than 200 U.S. soldiers in 2004. A declassified Defense Intelligence Agency report identified a Hezbollah-funded assassination unit called Unit 3800 that provided training, tactics, and technology to conduct kidnappings and small unit tactical operations to bleed the United States militarily. To the U.S. intelligence community, it was time to kill Imad Mughniyeh. Mayor Dagon met with CIA Director Michael Hayden. The minutes of the meeting remain classified. After completing a wave of regional assassinations in Lebanon, Mughniyeh moved to Damascus in 2006. Damascus was one of the most difficult and dangerous places for Mossad to operate, but the United States maintained an embassy there. CIA Director Hayden met with President Bush, who signed off on a presidential finding that allowed the CIA to use its Title 50 authority to kill Mughniyeh. If there was backlash, if the hidden hand were revealed, the White House would cite Article 51 of the UN Charter, the right to self-defense. General Petraeus had testified that a Hezbollah-like force was sending assassins into Iraq who'd been targeting and killing U.S. military personnel. There were conditions, President Bush is said to have told Hayden. There could be no collateral damage. No civilians passing by could be injured or killed. The targeted killing operation had to be precise. Kill Imad Mughniyeh and Mughniyeh alone. In 2007, a team of agency operators traveled to the Syrian capital and began tracking Mughniyeh's movements. For some time, Mossad had considered using a cell phone bomb, similar to the one that killed Hamas bomb maker Yahya Ayash, the engineer. That idea was ruled out after Unit 8200 determined that Mughniyeh too often changed out cell phones. One version of the events is that the United States now took the lead in engineering the device, At the Harvey Point defense testing activity in North Carolina, a team of explosives experts designed, built, and test-fired an array of devices. When engineers felt confident that they developed one with a blast radius precise enough to kill a single man only, they turned the device over to Mossad. Another version of events is that the Mossad built the bomb. But according to numerous sources interviewed for this book, both organizations were involved. This was a gigantic, multi-force operation with crazy resources invested by both countries, said a Mossad commander involved in the operation. To the best of my knowledge, the most ever invested to kill a lone individual. On the evening of February 12, 2008, Emad Mughniyeh met with senior Hezbollah commanders and members of the Radical Front in a building in the Kfar Susa neighborhood of Damascus. Shortly after 10:30, he exited the building. As he walked toward his 2006 Mitsubishi Pajero 4x4 parked in a lot down the street, two CIA paramilitary operators and a local asset had eyes on him. An explosion detonated around 10:45. A massive fireball engulfed the car, incinerating Emad Mughniyeh. It is said to have been detonated remotely by Mossad officers watching in Tel Aviv. Dozens of people rushed to the location, including several of the Hezbollah commanders with whom Mughniyeh had just met. The CIA operators on the street took photographs, and these images would be uploaded into agency databases for future use. "We were shocked to learn that he was killed in Syria," Mughniyeh's aunt told Agence France-Presse. "We thought he was safe there." For 7 years, the United States remained the hidden hand in this operation. Then, in January 2015, five former intelligence officials confirmed with Washington Post reporters Adam Goldman and Ellen Nakashima that the United States had built the bomb that killed Mughniyeh. The CIA declined to comment. Mark Regev, chief spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, told reporters, "We have nothing to add at this time." Mayor Dagan told 60 Minutes, "I'm not sorry to see the fact that he was perished from this world." The U.S. ban on assassination again came to the fore, with the oft-repeated statement, "Executive Order 12333 prohibits assassination," printed and reprinted around the world. Michael Hayden, as director of the CIA, acknowledged the less palatable truth. "Assassination," said Hayden, "is defined as forbidden lethal acts against political enemies. Terrorists are not political leaders. They do not run sovereign states. U.S. targeted killings against al-Qaeda are against members of an opposing armed enemy force," Hayden clarified. "This is war. This targeted killing of Mughniyeh is under the laws of armed conflict." As for the reports that the operation was a joint effort with Mossad, he said, "Israel is probably the only other country in the world who thinks like the United States, that what we do there, that is, in this calculus, is legal." "The Americans remember," Dagan said of Mughniyeh's attacks against the United States. He was referring to those killed in the U.S. Embassy and the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut in 1983, to the kidnapping, torture, and killing of Station Chief Bill Buckley in 1985, and to the deaths of hundreds of soldiers in Iraq. "They appear to be liberals, merciful, but they are far from that." One of the most curious footnotes to Mughniyeh's assassination is that there were no immediate retaliatory attacks by Hezbollah, neither against Israel nor the United States. no assassinations, no bombing attacks or kidnappings of prominent people in revenge. Perhaps Billy Wall was right, that blackmail really is the name of the game at the top, that whatever Mughniyeh was doing in Saudi Arabia involved a blackmail deal, the details of which, if released to the public, would make the martyr Mughniyeh appear shockingly treacherous. But there was much more going on than had been reported before. It would be another 10 years before a radical truth about the CIA's hidden hand operation became known.